Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We have to have all of the above. Alternative fuels. Wind, tide, solar, natural gas, clean coal technology.
Most importantly, by starting to invest in alternative energy, solar, wind, biodiesel, making sure that we're developing the fuel-efficient cars of the future right here in the United States.
30 issues in 30 days, issue 15, fossil fuels versus alternative energy. You hear both Obama and McCain talking positively about developing alternative fuels, and this was the issue that you voted number one during our pre-series online vote this summer for which issues to include in 30 issues in 30 days. And it's one of the issues in this presidential election series that many of you have actually helped to produce on our 30 issues wiki. You can see the wiki at wnyc.org/30issues. And thank you all for your contributions. This is great being able to do presidential election issue coverage as a collaboration with you, not just as sort of the media putting it out to you. And some of the things that you suggested that we will talk about this hour, why the last big energy independence push begun in the Carter administration did not succeed, what the downsides as well as the upsides are to various alternative energy sources. Windmill farms are ugly. Natural gas drilling in the upstate Marcellus Shale might threaten the New York City reservoirs. Some of you noted Al Gore's call last month for civil disobedience against big carbon emitters. We'll touch on that and a lot more. To begin with, a short vision of the future and an alternative glimpse of the present with two authors of books about road trips without any stops at gas stations. John Raymond Takacs describes himself as an inventor, an adventurer, and he's written a novel that imagines a car capable of powering itself. He joins us for just a few minutes. John Takacs, welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And after you, we'll talk to Greg Melville, who actually made a trip with a car that didn't need stops at gas stations. But you chose to write about energy independence as fiction for a reason. Why was that?
Well, what I found is that America has really become an entertainment-based society, and that if you really want to change opinions, you have to be able to entertain, kind of slip it between the pages, so to speak.
So how does the car that you imagined work?
Okay, well, you have to imagine this in your mind, but it's an electric car. It has batteries. And if you can see the back wheels turning here in your mind, and you can see it spinning and spinning as it goes down the road, if you were to put a pulley onto that back wheel, weld it on or whatever you would do, run it up to an alternator, and the particular tires that I used in the book has 20-inch rims, and it revolves about 700 RPMs per mile. So if you do that in 1 minute, that would be 700 RPMs. If you put a 2-inch pulley up to an alternator, that would make your alternator zing at 7,000 RPMs. And all that energy would go back into the battery and recharge it. Now, the cool thing is you just don't have one alternator. You have six big alternators.
Six big alternators. So it's not a subcompact-sized car.
No, I used my dad's old car. It's a 66 Buick, and took the engine out, took the transmission out, put the batteries way low under the car between the wheels, and it becomes a real stable, wide-based car. I mean, it's very, very safe.
Now, you say you did this with your dad's old car, so this is not just a work of fiction. You have tried to invent this very thing?
No. I used my dad's car in my imagination. No, I've never tried to do it because, honestly, I don't have the mechanical ability to do it. I had the idea and conceptualized it.
Right, even though you are an inventor, but you think this kind of thing is over your head.
I believe so, yeah, because I think the reason why it was never done before is mostly because of the computer. You would have to have a really good computer to do a lot of switching here. And also, alternator technology has really changed a lot in the last few years.
But do you think that there's an inventor out there that might take your vision, this imagination, and try to turn it into a reality? Or does this just, you know, do you just intend to symbolize something?
No. Actually, I'm looking for Wilbur and Orville right now to come out of his bicycle shop and begin this. I see this. In fact, let me go one step further than this. This is just one little idea here. Mm-hmm. There's a couple more ideas you could put together. For instance, if the car is going down the road at 60 miles per hour, you're going through the wind at 60 miles an hour. You just finished talking about all those windmills that you see alongside the highways here and there. Mm-hmm. What if you put little windmills inside your car and through some tubes, some air tubes, kind of look like a little jet engine, kind of, but it would be fixed into the car, and they wouldn't be windmills, of course, they'd be little turbines. But you could generate enough electricity there to extend the life of the batteries. Now, would it keep going forever? No, probably not, but it would extend the life. And then if you were to take that same car and all the flat surfaces, put little solar cells on it, so when the sun's coming down, it would also generate electricity. And you used all three of these things in combination. Do you think you could extend your battery life? And that's what it really gets about.
All right, a vision of possibilities from inventor, adventurer, and novelist Raymond Takacs. What's the name of your book?
It is called The Takacs. And there's information at thetakacs.com. And believe it or not, it will be in bookstores everywhere this weekend. And one last thing is the book went to Hollywood last weekend. So,
all right. Well, maybe if you call up John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji, they'll have you on the Take Us Away. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now Greg Melville, whose new nonfiction book is Greasy Rider, Two Dudes, One Fry Oil-Powered Car, and a Cross-Country Search for a Greener Future. He joins us in the midst of another road trip in, yes, his cooking oil-powered car. He is somewhere on I-95 south of Fredericksburg, Virginia, at a truck stop. And should I assume that you had some French fries at that truck stop?
Of course, I've got to support the fuel that I'm driving on. So, yes, I did.
So what is this fry oil power that you're using?
Well, basically, a century ago, Rudolf Diesel invented the diesel engine to run on vegetable oil. I guess his vision was to break people free from the shackles of the oil companies. And good to see a lot has changed in the last 100 years. So basically, a diesel engine can already run on vegetable oil. And I just have a separate tank that stores waste restaurant oil, and I warm the car up on regular diesel, and it heats up the vegetable oil so that it's the right viscosity. It's liquid like regular diesel gas would be, and literally I just press a button on the fly, and it sends in the vegetable oil as opposed to the diesel fuel into the engine, and off I go.
Wow. Go ahead.
Sorry. I tend to get my fuel from restaurants. I live in Asheville, North Carolina right now, and so I get it from a supplier there. And when I drove across the country without stopping at a fuel pump with a buddy, we begged, borrowed, and asked for vegetable oil from restaurants along the way.
And so for anybody else who might want to do this, what are the finer points of used fry oil? Will any old oil do?
Pretty much. You want to go to restaurants that change oil more frequently because it's just easier to clean the oil. I have a very simple system where I just send it through a filter bag. But Mexican restaurants and Chinese restaurants use good oil. They don't fry a lot of fats, and so it makes for good driving.
And how many miles per walkful do you get?
Well, you know, it depends. When I'm driving around town, the car has to warm up on regular diesel, so I may get 40, 50, 60, 70 miles to the gallon because I'm stopping and starting. But when we drove across the country, we made it 3,900 miles on 4 gallons of regular dyno diesel, so I guess that works out to about 1,000 miles a gallon.
Does the car smell like filet of fish?
Yeah, it depends on what the restaurant was frying. So sometimes it might smell a little like fried chicken, other times like onion rings. But to me, it smells like energy independence. That's what I like to say.
Energy independence. But what motivated you to convert your car? Independence from foreign producers of fuel or global warming and things like that?
Well, at the start, obviously I had kind of an environmental aspect to it. It was definitely one of the reasons. But really, the big motivator was money. A lot of restaurants pay to get the waste grease emptied out of their dumpsters, so they're happy to give it away for free if someone's going to take it off their hands. So when I was living in Burlington, Vermont, which is where my cross-country trip started from, a restaurant supplied me with the oil, and they were happy to do it. And so I, you know, same thing down in Asheville, North Carolina now. So basically I get my my gas for free. So it's part environment and also part plain economics.
So we talked to John Takas about his idea of alternator-powered cars that don't need any gasoline. We're hearing how you're actually doing it and driving across the country with fry oil. Do you think the solution to energy independence will come from people's backyards and garages as opposed to the big research labs at corporations and universities?
Well, you know, to me, I don't care where it comes from. I hope it comes from somewhere. But you're right. It does seem like a lot of the innovation is coming from people's garages. I know that the kit that I use, I actually bought the kit from a company called Grease Car, and that was literally a guy who invented the kit in his garage. So, I mean, it could very well come from someone's garage. I know that a lot of great innovation has come from garages in the past, so we'll see.
Greg Melville, author of Greasy Rider, Two Dudes, One Fry Oil-Powered Car, and A Cross-Country Search for a Greener Future. Happy motoring.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 15, Fossil Fuels versus Alternative Energy. More in a minute. No, they're not chanting USA, USA. If you couldn't make it out, that, of course, is a crowd of McCain-Palin supporters joining the Republican ticket's rallying cry for expanded domestic oil production. They were chanting, drill, baby, drill. As we continue our 30 Issues in 30 Days presidential election series, today looking at oil and other forms of energy, we'll parse the issue, dissect the positions of the presidential candidates, and something you co-producers on the Wiki were very interested in, attempt to answer the question, where would we be today if we had followed the plan for energy independence put forward a generation ago in the wake of the OPEC embargo? That's a quote from one of your posts. You can see everybody's contributions to this segment at wnyc.org/30issues. With us to discuss all these things are Antonia Yuhas, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the author of The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It, out this month from William Morrow, and David Croy, senior policy analyst in energy economics and climate change with the Heritage Foundation. David, welcome to WNYC, and Antonia, welcome back. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning.
So energy independence has, of course, become a major theme in the presidential campaign, with both candidates calling it essential, both for national security and environmental protection. But we have been here before, as listener Nicholas Jay points out on our Wiki. He notes that a generation ago, President Carter put solar panels on the White House roof, and Americans moved to smaller cars with better gas mileage. Antonia, why didn't we stick with the Energy Independence Initiative of 1979, and where would we be today if we had? Nicholas Jay wants to know.
First of all, we were very successful for a period of time in significantly reducing both domestic and international demand for oil. One reason was a massive conservation effort. In fact, it was Henry Kissinger who was one of the masterminds of that conservation effort, because he wanted to use it to break OPEC. It was one of the tools in our tool belt that we used to actually in many ways successfully break the price-setting ability of the OPEC powers. And we were moving ahead quite successfully on that conservation effort. I would say the biggest problem with it came along in the 80s with the Reagan administration, where the administration made a very focused effort at shifting course, doing whatever was possible to increase demand for oil and oil products, to literally take the solar panels, you know, off the White House, turn that thermostat way back up, and allow for some pretty significant changes in domestic U.S. policy that made it possible to take the antitrust reins off the U.S. oil and gas industry, allow some pretty massive series of mergers that really shifted course in shifting more power and concentration into the hands of the U.S. oil industry, allowing the giants that we have today to essentially reconverge and reform themselves, take consolidated control over our refinery sector, over our marketing, gas station sector, send the price up, and put us into the contribute significantly to the fairly dismal situation that we find ourselves in today.
So, David Kreutzer, why did President Reagan do that? And with the benefit of hindsight, do you think he did the right thing?
Absolutely. It's strange that we would see the Reagan administration as being problematic concerning energy. First of all, we've had 25 years since 1980, roughly, 25 years of low energy prices and 3 years of high prices, and so it's odd that we somehow say there's a huge problem that we should have solved back in 1979. We had, back in the 70s, we heard the same thing, is the oil companies are causing the problem, the oil companies are causing the problem. If you looked at surveys back then, people wanted more stringent price controls, they wanted ration coupons, they wanted windfall profits taxes. All of those things work against the people consuming oil. It makes makes oil more scarce, it makes the price go up. In place of price controls, we had lines. The Reagan administration got rid of those controls, and the solar panels on the White House weren't doing much, so I wouldn't worry one way or the other, they could have kept them.
But it was a symbolic
it
was a symbolic step, and if we look at our relationship with the oil producing nations of the world, after Carter tried to start to redefine that relationship, and in fact our relationship with oil as a commodity, It sounds like, for whatever reason, we stop dead in our tracks.
Well, I don't know about symbolic steps. Don't do much good if they cause shortages of petroleum. Carter was simply playing to the polls.
One at a time. Go ahead, David.
Yeah. Carter was simply playing to the polls. It was not good economics. We had much better energy policy in the 80s and 90s. We had affordable energy. It's a good thing we didn't stick with the Carter program.
And, Antonia, you said that one of the results of the Reagan policy was that oil prices went up. But didn't we have low energy costs pretty much through the 80s and 90s?
Right. It took a period of transition. I would say this is part of the fruit that we're bearing now, very similarly, excuse me, with the banking sector and mortgage crisis deregulation and similarly antitrust deregulation. We're bearing the fruit of those bad choices begun in the 80s. But first of all, it wasn't Carter's energy policies that led to the long lines at the gas stations. In 1979, essentially it was U.S. oil companies that first got very afraid, led by the Iranian oil embargo, that oil supplies were going to get very tight very suddenly. And the oil industry stockpiled its oil. It then simultaneously let all of the oil out at the same time, creating a massive oil glut that led to a massive decline in prices, which sent oil prices plummeting downward. Now, the oil industry got in trouble, and the price went down. Remember when the price was going down? First, we had the 70s nationalizations that definitely started weakening the oil industry. But then we had the process over the 80s of the Saudis nationalizing. We had the oil moving out of the hands of the oil industry in a significantly sizable way. This is, the period when the price of oil was dropping. This was following, sorry to bounce back and forth a bit, price of oil skyrocketed in 1979. It led to a massive global recession, which sent very, very similar to now. This was the previous period when oil surpassed or reached $100 a barrel for the first time until we surpassed it this time. Led to a massive global recession, reduced demand everywhere, kept the price of oil down everywhere, and sent the oil industry searching after its nationalizations, after the price of oil declined, hunting for new sources of oil. The place that the oil industry essentially found those new sources of oil was by gobbling each other up back in the United States, turning back to the United States a sector it had somewhat abandoned in terms of profitability in the refinery and the gas station sectors, turned its attention back to the United States, started gobbling each other up, started concentrating, regained control within the refinery sector, within the gas station sector, started reclaiming now up to about 13% of the world's oil, but most importantly, regained its sizable political influence, leading to really significant changes in 2000, which have led the price of oil to go up, which we can hopefully, I'll come back and start there, start in 2000, which is when the price of oil began its climb.
David, very briefly, because I actually want to jump ahead to the
we
present.
We've got to get the history straight. The oil nationalization started with Muammar Gaddafi in the early 1970s. The oil line started in the 70s. Prices skyrocketed with the oil. Arab oil embargo was not 1979. That was a second bump up. And the oil companies have been influential forever. I mean, I don't see why all of a sudden we say they've got power in the last 3 years and they didn't have it in the past 35 or 70 years.
So, Antonio,
but
let's continue from 2000 because oil prices were, again, still pretty low until quite recently, if you're going to trace something back to 2000. And the going analysis that I usually hear, Antonia, is that the big reason for the rising price of oil, and by the way, remember the good old days of 2 months ago when we thought that was our biggest economic problem? But the rising price of oil was caused primarily by the middle class of China and India. So there's so much more demand for the same oil. Do you reject that?
I think that certainly rising demand in China and India and in the United States in particular has certainly contributed to the rising price in oil. But I would actually pinpoint the most important change being two things. One, when I talk about the increased power of this industry, I'm talking about when the industry was permitted to begin its massive merger run, and that was when we started, beginning in the early 90s is when it began, 2,600 mergers in the oil and gas industry alone, but really when it picked up speed with Exxon and Mobil being allowed to merge. Earlier in the 80s, Chevron bought Gulf, then bought Texaco, then bought Unocal, Conoco, and Phillips merging, BP being permitted to buy Amoco and Arco, creating these massive, the most profitable companies in the history of the world, no comparison whatsoever with any other industry, beginning in 2000. And what started happening in 2000 wasn't just these mega mergers. It was deregulation of the crude oil futures market.
And all right. I have to keep this short because we have to move on from history to the present. But, David, I'll give you one more response.
Yeah. We had the increase in demand. What happened was in the 80s and 90s, prices were cheap. It didn't make a whole lot of sense to do a lot of exploring and drilling, especially in the late 90s. 1999, North America, 488 drilling rigs were operating. They're now four or five times that many. When the price started going up, the oil company said, hey, we've been fooled before. We were fooled in the 80s. We over-drilled. Price didn't even cover our cost of getting it out of the ground in some places. When they finally realized that it was here to stay, they started drilling more, and that's what they're doing worldwide. Lots of drilling going on, and it's going to take a little while to catch up.
All right. Two views of history, which will not be reconciled here, but interesting stuff. Antonia Juhas, my guest, author of The Tyranny of Oil, the world's most powerful industry and what we must do to stop it. And David Kreutzer, also my guest, senior policy analyst in energy economics and climate change with the Heritage Foundation, as we do 30 issues in 30 days, issue 15, oil versus alternative energy, with a lot of help from many of you on our 30 issues wiki. Now, I want to get right into the presidential race. I thought it was important to do a little bit of history and that it was a great idea that one of our listeners suggested some of that history on the wiki. Obama's position on offshore drilling seems to have shifted. We know that the McCain supporters are out there chanting drill, baby, drill at the rallies. But there was some debate on Obama's position on the wiki with listeners parsing Obama's various statements. Now, we have two clips of Barack Obama speaking in Lansing, Michigan in August, in which he appears to say two things about drilling. Here's the first one.
The truth is, none of these steps will come close to seriously reducing our energy dependence in the long term. We can't simply pretend, as Senator McCain does, that we can drill our way out of this problem. We need a much bolder and much bigger set of solutions. We have to make a serious nationwide commitment to developing new sources of energy, and we have to do it right away. Right now. We cannot wait.
Later in that same speech, however,
I also believe that in the short term, as we transition to renewable energy, we can and should increase our domestic production of oil and natural gas.
Can and should increase our domestic production of oil and natural gas, Senator Obama in Lansing, Michigan, on August the 4th. So, David Kreutzer, is he for domestic drilling or against it?
It doesn't seem like he's as much for it as McCain, though I don't think his position is completely contradictory. I don't agree with him, but he's saying we need something now to tide us over to the longer term, and I'd agree with that. You know, go ahead, but that means drilling now and not sitting on our thumbs and not pretending that we don't have any oil we can get.
Tell me how that's different from McCain, because I think McCain says we need to do everything. We certainly need to develop alternative energy sources, both for environmental reasons and for energy independence reasons. But in the meantime, we have to throw everything that we can, with domestic oil at it. How is what Obama just said there different from that?
I would say I would interpret Obama as being less enthusiastic about going for the outer continental shelf oil. In other statements that he's made, he says he would do it only as part of a package that he really didn't like drilling there, but if we could do it to get some of the things he does want. Whereas I think McCain wants to do it without other conditions.
What would some of those conditions be for Obama as you understand them, David?
I think it would mean increased funding for research on alternatives or actual subsidies for alternative energy and jobs programs and all sorts of other things.
Are you against that? Is McCain against that?
I don't speak for McCain, but my understanding is he doesn't. He's not in favor of having job subsidies, trying to create, training programs to teach people how to fill holes in buildings and so on. No, I think we need to be careful that we don't oversell alternatives too soon. That is, if we try to push our way into alternatives by cutting back on the energy sources that we know work and that we do have for now, by saying we have mandates for renewable, mandates for a certain percent of electric generation, that we're going to force windmills, for instance, which are intermittent, fairly expensive if you look at but the per kilowatt hour, we give them a good subsidy, and still, because of the intermittency, they're not a desirable source of energy right now.
We give oil subsidies too, don't we?
Take them away. Take them all away.
Okay. So that's the heritage position, Antonio.
That's the heritage position,
Antonio. Do you hear Obama's position and the distinction between Obama and McCain on this any differently than David does?
Well, only slightly. I mean, I think McCain. Both McCain and Obama reversed their previous opposition to offshore drilling during this campaign. The Congress reversed its previous opposition to offshore drilling during this campaign. Let me emphasize one word, campaign. They're trying to get money from the oil and gas industry, and they got it. McCain in particular, a huge, massive influx of oil industry money after he reversed his position. By the way, the second big, sizable influx of money into the McCain camp after he put Palin on the ticket, because what is her favorite rallying cry? Drill, baby, drill. I mean, look, we are already the third largest oil producer in the world. We drill a lot. We drill plenty. We drill so much that right now we have massive excess stocks of oil sitting around the United States. We have higher stocks today than we had in 2000, and we've had higher stocks. What's happening is that the oil is sitting in storage facilities, or the oil companies are choosing increasingly since 2006, by the way, to export more petroleum products and more oil.
So wait a minute. This would be new. Antonio, I want to stop you there focus in on that, because this would be new to a lot of our listeners. You're saying
it's new to me.
Number one, we're the third largest oil producer in the world. Number two, you're saying if they drill in Anwar, or drill off Florida or whatever, that some of that oil wouldn't just be used to create energy independence. Some of it might actually be exported to other countries for their use?
Oh, yeah. I mean, mean, these are global companies, right? The largest producers of oil in the United States, and I'm not going to get this exactly in the right order, but it's BP, it's Exxon, it's Shell, it's Chevron, it's ConocoPhillips, it's Occidental. These are global companies. They're going to sell where it's profitable to sell, and increasingly that's been outside of the United States as demand has increased elsewhere. If we want to deal with energy independence, drilling isn't the way to do it. Reducing consumption is the way to do it, overall, total consumption. And if we want to deal with prices, which is ultimately what the bill of sales were being sold, is that if we increase production, we'll decrease gas prices. That's absolutely ludicrous, because as stocks have increased in the United States, as supply has increased, prices of gasoline have increased as well, and that has everything to do with the concentration that I was talking about earlier. Concentration in refining, concentration in marketing, and most importantly, the price of oil. The reason why the increase has been so rapid, so quick, began in 2000 with deregulation. We've got the primary price setter of oil right now, deregulated crude oil futures market, governed by the big banks, governed by big oil, totally deregulated, and that is what sent the price skyrocketing and what has made it so ridiculously volatile right now.
So, David Kreutzer, first of all, Saudi Arabia, Greenland, U.S., and why wouldn't a lot of that domestic production go overseas? Because the oil companies are not actually U.S. nationalists. They're globalized countries who will sell the oil wherever they can make the money.
Right. It is a global market. We need to look at that because we're still going to be importing millions of barrels a day. We're not going to get away from that. We hope to reduce it perhaps, but we're going to be a net importer for as far as I can see.
So what are risking environmental damage with domestic drilling for?
We're not risking environmental damage, and it will lower the price. It's a ludicrous notion.
We're not risking environmental damage?
It's ludicrous to say that more oil will not lower the price. Of course it will. This is a global market, very tight. Because supply has not increased as fast as demand in the last 4 or 5 years, and we have excess capacity went down to less than a million barrels per day, probably from 5 million barrels a day as recently as 3 or 4 years ago. And when you have that situation, somebody in China buys a car that's never had a car. If somebody else in the world has to get out of their car. When you have 5 million barrels of excess capacity, somebody in China buys a car that never had a car, we can pump additional oil. The price doesn't go up anywhere near as much. And so that's what we've seen. Very, very tight markets, you get very volatile price changes.
But
observed that.
Let me follow up on that with some other posts from our wiki, because people are pointing, this is a composite of various things that people have written in, Anwar and parts of the outer continental shelf where McCain would drill contain an estimated 28 billion barrels of oil is the number that I have here. At our levels of consumption, that's a drop in the bucket or a drop in the barrel, and oil from Anwar or offshore would not be available for 10 years, a lot of people were very anxious to point out. Fair?
Not completely fair. It will take, it depends on the political will. I mean, we built the Alaska pipeline in 2 years, 2 months, and 4 days, and that was 800 miles. So we can get to the Anwar oil sooner than 10 years if we really want. Southern California, that offshore oil is very close, very easy to get. Atlantic, 10 years, okay. But you don't have to have a 20% increase in production to get price to go down by 20%. The ratio is more like 10 or 20 to 1. So if you have a 2% increase in production, you're going to get a 20 or 40% decrease in price, depending on how quickly it comes online. So we've seen that. That's why we've had such volatile prices in the past year.
And Antonia, very briefly, like 30 seconds, you disagree with that.
Boy, yeah, I can't respond in 20 seconds, but let me just say really quickly. I quote a Chevron employee in my book who says that offshore drilling is very expensive, very risky, and I quote, a total crapshoot. $120 million per hole. They use diamond-encrusted drills. 80% of the holes in the Gulf are dry holes. Yes, it would take a serious amount of money and time to go out into the Gulf, and the idea that this is green or clean technology is ridiculous. Let me just quote one statistic among many, but any offshore hole at 500 feet or more, and we're talking offshore drilling at 1,000 feet, 5,000 feet, releases methane, a greenhouse gas at least 20 times more potent 20 times than CO2 in its contribution to global warming. So if we believe, like Governor Palin does, that global warming is a real phenomenon, it's affecting her state, then we're gonna say that there's no consequence for drilling all of those holes, which 80% aren't even going to give us any oil, so that we can release 20 times more greenhouse gas potent chemicals. I mean, this is ridiculous.
All right, so let me.
You don't want oil.
I don't want oil. I would like to see us do everything we can to regulate this industry such that we tell it where we don't want it to go and where we do. I want them to clean up their refineries. I want them to have nice, clean, green refineries. I want them to use their money there. I don't want them to go in the tar sands. I don't want them to go in the shale. I don't want them to go offshore. I want them to clean up their practices now.
Does anybody else get a say in where they get to do this stuff?
Well, you've actually put your finger on it, David, I think, because I think one of the basic divides here is that Republicans, I don't want to overgeneralize, but Republicans want mostly to get us off foreign oil, and Democrats mostly want to get us off any oil. So the bottom line goals are disentangling with the Middle East versus stopping global warming and disengaging with the power of the oil industry. Antonia, would you disagree with that distinction?
I'm afraid I wouldn't make quite such a strong Democrat-Republican divide, but I would certainly say that that is a very clear difference, a very clear distinction.
Maybe. I see way too many huge 4x4s with Obama stickers to believe that.
Yeah.
that's, you know, maybe that's what they think they're doing, but they sure don't act like they believe it.
Certainly would be a good question to ask the people in the 4x4s with the Obama stickers.
One
of our Wiki contributors asked about the willingness of the federal government to heavily invest in alternative energy R&D. The logic of the market alone, they write, will never deliver new energy systems due to the upfront costs and the risks involved. Here is Obama, then we'll hear from McCain, talking about investment in alternatives from the second debate.
That's why I've called for an investment of $15 billion a year over 10 years. Our goal should be, in 10 years' time, we are free of dependence on Middle Eastern oil. And we can do it.
We can move forward and clean up our climate and develop green technologies and alternative energies for hybrid, for hydrogen, for battery-powered cars, so that we can clean up our environment and at the same time get our economy going by creating millions of jobs. We can do that.
All right. Maybe in the coming recession, that's the WPA of the 21st century, is green jobs created by the government. And certainly in that clip, David, John McCain doesn't sound like he's opposed to a lot of government subsidies and programs for alternative energy development.
Yeah, let me reiterate, I am not a spokesman for John McCain.
I'm just asking you to analyze him. To
right,
analyze
okay. Them. Yeah, I think it's hard not to say that. Who's against knowing more?
Yeah.
All right, it's when you get to how many tens and hundreds of billions of dollars are you willing to spend for investment, and where is it going to be invested, and who's going to decide where this is going to be spent?
Yeah.
Then we can have some differences.
Antonia, last thing before you both go, and we're going to bring on one more guest to talk about the nuclear piece of this. While there's a lot of animosity among our listeners on our wiki and suspicion toward the oil industry, alternative sources aren't a panacea. Again, here somebody points out, I'm going to quote, wind power is an unsightly, sporadic producer of electricity, which depends on federal subsidies to be economically feasible. Hydroelectric can damage free-flowing rivers. Natural gas from deep wells like the Marcellus Formation in New York endangers water resources and disrupts large portions of forest and farmland, unquote. So they ask, should we really be focusing on reducing our demand for energy rather than constantly racing to find new ways to fuel our flat-screen, 3-TV, central air-conditioned, multiple electronic device lifestyle? Antonia.
Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, essentially, we have to do two things. We do have to, and when I say we, I particularly mean we in the United States, reduce our consumption. There's just no alternative. I mean, we consume, just in terms of oil, 4 to 6 barrels of oil for every one that we produce. We're going to run out of oil. But there isn't, as your listeners point out, some magical panacea of another alternative that will ever be able to replace the amount of consumption that we currently engage in. We also have to lead by example. So right now, India, for example, is trying to model our massive highway expansion program from the 50s. why don't we model instead? And when I talk about green jobs, I talk about how about a massive WPA program in public transit? Let's model how we can actually transition away from using fossil fuels as much as possible, using cars as much as possible, and let's look at localizing our consumption as well. I'm actually not in favor of a T. Boone Pickens becoming the largest landowner in the United States and water owner in the United States for solar and wind. I'm interested in more localized production, more local consumption, and reduced consumption. And I'm not saying that's a panacea either. That, of course, has its problems as well. But we're going to have to make some tough choices. We've put ourselves in a tough position. The good news is there's all kinds of great, you know, ideas. We've had amazing ideas, you know, since the 70s, since earlier, of course, in alternative forms of energy and ways of building green, smaller cities and ways of reducing our consumption. It's just time to start implementing.
David, 30 seconds.
You know, Mark, people do conserve in response to higher prices. Right now they're buying more economical cars. They're getting rid of those behemoths. That's a market response. That's way ahead of the CAFE regulations that are coming in 2012. Firms do want to find additional sources of energy if they're cheaper. That's how they make money. We've seen that in the past. We got away from whale oil into petroleum. This is not new, and markets do respond.
And as the Dow has hit 8,200 this morning, the price of oil is down to $80 a barrel.
So that's not how we wanted to bring it down, but it did.
There it is. Antonio Yuhas, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. And David Kreutzer, Senior Policy Analyst in Energy, Economics, and Climate Change with the Heritage Foundation. Thank you both very much.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
And we'll tack the nuclear piece onto this. Obama, did you notice, also spoke positively about nuclear energy in his convention speech. How different are the candidates on that? Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and for those of you following the presidential race closely, you might be interested in our free podcast, Digesting Politics. WNYC political director Andrea Bernstein and I sit down over lunch once a week and talk about the presidential race. Digesting Politics is a web-only feature that you won't hear on the radio. We'll be recording a new one this afternoon. Sign up for the Digesting Politics podcast for free at WNYC.org. It's 30 Issues in 30 Days, our presidential election series, issue 15 today, fossil fuels versus alternative energy. And we'll spend our last few minutes talking about another alternative to fossil fuels, which is no less controversial, and that is nuclear power. Now, Obama, in his convention speech, said that nuclear power is not a panacea, but that it should be, and this may surprise you, part of our energy picture. So here's a clip from Obama's convention speech. His emphasis afterwards was on being able to safely harness it, and he references that here too.
As president, I will tap our natural gas reserves, invest in clean coal technology, and find ways to safely harness nuclear power.
And he says Illinois has more nuclear reactors, his state, than any other state. People still invoke the accidents at Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, but he says we know that nuclear power has become a much safer form of energy to produce. Here is a clip of Senator McCain from last week's debate arguing that nuclear is safer than Obama thinks it is.
What's the best way of fixing it? Nuclear power. Senator Obama says it has to be safe or disposable or something like that. Look, I was on Navy ships that had nuclear power plants. Nuclear power is safe and it's clean, and it creates hundreds of thousands of jobs. And I know that we can reprocess the spent nuclear fuel. The Japanese, the British, and the French do it, and we can do it too.
With me now is Klaus Lackner, director of the Lenfest Center for Sustainable Energy at the Earth Institute of Columbia University. Another guest suggested by one of you, Miriam in Ithaca, on our 30 Issues in 30 Days wiki page. Klaus, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Well, thank you for having me.
So how would you distinguish between Obama and McCain there? Obama said it flat out in his convention speech, we do need to go forward, and we don't have any new nuclear power plants in this country in 30 years, and there was Obama, the Democrat, saying we need to have new ones, but McCain saying, nah, he's worried about safe or disposable or something like that.
I think both of them are right. Obama is right that we will need nuclear energy because it is part of the necessary mix to look at things. And yes, it is important that we look at it and make it safe. And I do believe it is important that the industry heeds the public opinion and listens to the public opinion and may have to go the extra mile people don't think is necessary. But I think in the industry may not think is necessary, but if people want to be convinced on the case of nuclear, you do have to go the extra mile. But if you step back for a second, if you look at the world as a whole, if 10 billion people in 50 years from now were to consume energy like we did, the world would consume 10 times as much energy as today. If, on the other hand, you want to deal with the CO2 problem, CO2 emissions really have to come down by approximately a factor 3 in order to stabilize the CO2 levels in the atmosphere. Otherwise, it will go up.
Let me read a comment to you from the wiki from Patricia Taylor in New York City, and she writes, although I dislike the idea of nuclear power and think nothing new should be built before there's a solution to the storage issue, a speaker at the State of the Planet 08 at Columbia last spring made a good point. She noted that one of the reasons the nuclear plants in France have been so safe and successful is that, unlike in the U.S., they use the standard design model. That way, all parts are interchangeable and continue to be manufactured, and an employee at one plant there can easily switch to a different plant without extra training, I should say. So is there something to be learned from the French and some other European and Asian countries who have done this?
Yes, I think there is something to be learned. I don't think it only addresses safety. It ultimately addresses cost. And I think it's important. Extra safety tends to cost extra. If you want to go one extra step, you have to work a little harder, and that costs money, and standardization will lower the cost. And therefore, I think there's a lot to be learned from the experience in France.
How close do you think the industry is to the kind of resolution of the safety and disposal issues that Senator Obama says he would need to be satisfied about before going forward?
I think we are actually quite close. A lot of that is also about the political will, which will change if the climate change issue stays on the front burner and becomes more important, because one thing is certainly true. Nuclear energy produces no CO2.
Do you... Well, I actually want to replay the McCain clip and ask you about a specific piece of it. Listen.
What's the best way of fixing it? Nuclear power. Senator Obama says it has to be safe or disposable or something like that. Look, I was on Navy ships that had nuclear power plants. Nuclear power is safe and it's clean, and it creates hundreds of thousands of jobs. And I know that we can reprocess the spent nuclear fuel. The Japanese, the British, and the French do it. And we can do it, too.
He really dismissed the safety. He said safe, disposable, something like that. And he says we can reprocess now. And he's basically saying we're there. What's your reaction to that dismissiveness?
Well, I think in part that depends on what level you are asking about, how much you demand from it. It is certainly true. We know where to put this, the waste. We can store it in a place in Yucca Mountain. But people do point out we don't know all of the bits and pieces, and we probably should enhance this effort and go further. You can go to Finland, where people have shown how to put things deep underground into granite into a way that it's more or less irretrievably stuck there, and we know it can stay there much longer than it would be in Yucca Mountain. Again, I think much of this is not that we don't have technology, but that we don't have quite the political will to on both sides. On the one side, we say, trust us, it's safe, and we could do more, but we don't really want to. And on the other side, you need to be convinced that there is a need to do it. So yeah. I think nuclear energy is in this boundary between these two places where the public will to deal with it is not quite there yet. On the other hand, the public can be convinced because I think the technologies to do that are actually available, but it takes time and we need to go the extra mile to convince the public.
It's interesting that Finland is the model. The former Prime Minister of Finland just won the Nobel Peace Prize
this morning.
A president, I should say. Just in 20 seconds then, another Obama quote from Jacksonville, Florida in June. He said, I don't think it's our optimal energy source because we haven't figured out how to store the waste safely or recycle the waste. Literally 20 seconds. Can we store it deep underground like the Finns do? Can we do that at Yucca Mountain or anywhere else?
I think Yucca Mountain is not quite designed to do it. By design, I would view this as more of a temporary storage because you want to retrieve it for future recycle. I do believe right now recycling the fuel and reprocessing it is not economic against the price of uranium, but we want to have access to the material in the future. In parallel to this, we have to develop permanent, safe, and irretrievable storage along the lines the Finns have it. So this is not a technological issue, but something which can be done.
Klaus Lackner, director of the Lenfest Center for Sustainable Energy at the Earth Institute of Columbia University, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's our 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 15. Oil and alternative energy. Hey, in case you're interested, I'll be talking about some of this week's news on television tonight as part of the Reporters' Roundtable on New York One. That's around 7:30 and 10:30 tonight. Have a great weekend. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.